Hi, I'm Spider Robinson, and you found Spider on the Web number 31, a user-supported fiasco being podcast, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. I have to begin this week with a special thank you to all those who've donated so generously in the past couple of weeks. Please rest assured I'm going to keep on doing this as long as possible, and I thank you for your kindness. I'm sorry I posted late last week. I suffered from deadlines, causing what Lord Buckley used to call pavement rash. And I passed it in late to my friend and webmaster, Colin McDonald, who God knows has plenty of deadlines of his own to worry about. One of them, for instance, is a world premiere this Monday, February 25th, of a great new piece, a percussion quartet called Ingenuity, commissioned by Vancouver's The Fringe Group as part of the Chutzpah Festival. I've heard it, and it's terrific, and I hope he'll let me podcast it in months to come. But for now, here's a live performance from January 2007 by the Colin McDonald Pocket Orchestra, of another one of Colin's compositions, one of my favorites, the subtly titled The Five-Chambered Heart.
Thank you.
That was The Five-Chambered Heart by Colin McDonald. If you can't catch the premiere of Ingenuity on Monday, the Fringe Group will also be playing it twice more that week on Wednesday, February 27th at noon at the UBC School of Music for $4 a head at the door, and on Thursday at 11 p.m. at Douglas College Auditorium for, it says here, as cheap as free. The premiere on Monday the 25th takes place at Norman Rothstein Theater in Vancouver, and tickets are available at https://tickets.ticketstonight.ca/eventperformances.asp?EVT=473. Honest to God, that's the URL. Now I'm going to read you a few excerpts from my novel Very Bad Deaths, in part because a sequel to it, Very Hard Choices, will be published in hardcover by Bain Books in April. And by the way, some of you may be glad to know it has a far less scary villain than its predecessor, who gave nightmares to many, including me. I got an email at the end of last week from a reader named Tim Clark, who wrote, Dear Spider, I'm in trouble here. I missed Valentine's Day, and my beautiful wife, who was also kind enough not to strangle me in my sleep for this oversight, even if she did cuddle up to the shotgun last night, really does deserve something special. Since you also happen to be one of her favorite wordsmiths, I thought that it might just get me back into her good graces if you'd be willing to dedicate a reading to her in the next podcast. Not the story, but the reading. And maybe throw in the fact that after these 9 years of marriage, I'm still ecstatic waking up and smelling her morning breath every day. Unless we had Mexican food the night before, in which case I'm really thrilled. Her name is Katie, and I love her. Mea culpa, I'm wearing ass's ears over here. Signed, Tim Clark. He adds in a P.S., see attached picture and try to appreciate my position here. Attached is a picture of Katie, and I see his problem. His wife is much too good for him, and he knows it. I'm in much the same position myself. So I dedicate the podcasting of these excerpts this week to Katie Clark and hope that she'll cut the guy a break and not award him one of the very bad deaths.
A.D. Trembling on the Verge, Heron Island, British Columbia, Canada. Chapter 1. I was 54 years old the first time a dead person spoke to me. Wouldn't you know it, it was the wrong one. To be fair, he did manage to save my life. Just for openers. I don't actually believe in ghosts. I stopped believing in them even before I stopped believing in the Catholic Church, and that puts it pretty far back. Not that many years after I stopped believing in Santa. It's just that a few decades later, I stopped disbelieving in ghosts, too. My wife Susan told me that when she was in her mid-twenties, at a time when she was awake and not under the influence of drugs, her dead father appeared to her. She said he asked for her forgiveness, and she gave it. I never knew Susan to tell a lie unless it was to spare someone's feelings, and she had fewer delusions than just about anyone else I ever met. She had been dead herself for 5 years now, and I still hadn't given up hoping to hear from her. She didn't need my forgiveness, and I'd had all I was ever going to have of hers, and like I said, I didn't believe in ghosts. But still, I hoped. So I guess I didn't entirely disbelieve in them either. It was about the time they are traditionally reputed to appear, too, sometime between 3 and 4 in the morning. Despite the hour, I was, as Susan had been for her own visitation, wide awake, and not under the influence of drugs unless you're enough of a purist to count coffee or marijuana. This was normal for me. All my life I've been a night owl, and now I had a job that allowed me to get away with it. And with Susan gone and our son Jesse on the other side of the planet, there was absolutely no reason not to do so. I write an opinion column called The Fifth Horseman that runs twice a week in the Globe and Mail, Canada's national newspaper, so basically I think hard for a living. What better time to do that than the middle of the night, when there's nothing on TV and nothing that isn't mellow on the radio, nobody comes to the door, the phone doesn't ring, and nobody anywhere in earshot is using a chainsaw, swinging a hammer, practicing an electric guitar, or riding a motorcycle. And what better place than my office? It's a small outbuilding that was originally a pottery studio, well heated, soundproof enough to permit me to scream obscenities in the small hours if that's what the job calls for, though that's less important now that I live alone. The noisiest thing in it is my hard drive. It sits a whole 6 steps away from the house, overgrown cabin, really, which, now that Susan's not living in it anymore, is basically just the place my coffee and food come from and go back to, and where I spend the daylight hours in a coffin of my native earth. The noisiest things in the house are the furnace, fridge compressor, and cat. House and office sit together on a secluded bluff at the end of a long, tire-killing pair of ruts that wind through thick woods in an out-of-the-way corner of an island that's 40 minutes by ferry from North America and contains a bit over 2,000 permanent residents, 2 sidewalks, and not a single street light or traffic light. The noisiest thing on it in the middle of a weeknight is generally an owl or a cat in love with mine. Given this unusual tranquility, stillness, and peace, this near-perfect opportunity for contemplation and reflection, naturally I play a lot of music. Jazz and blues CDs, mostly. Sometimes I sing along. Contemplation needs a little challenge, the way cookies need a little salt. All things considered, I have an ideal existence for someone of my temperament and tastes. That night, however, the stillness and quiet were lost on me. That night, nothing anywhere had any salt or any other flavor. I wasn't writing a column or trying to or even trying to dream up an idea for one. I wasn't surfing the web for either research or amusement. I wasn't reading. The walls of the office were almost totally obscured by a couple of thousand cherished books. Not one contained a line I wished to reread. I wasn't even listening to music. Nearly 300 CDs lay within arm's reach. Not one of them held a single track I wanted to hear. The telephone, hanging on the wall beside my desk, connected me directly to everyone else on the planet. I could think of none who were any use to me. I was no longer trying to decide whether to kill myself, only how and how soon. A perfect life, without Susan in it, simply hurt too much to bear. I had been denying that for over a year now, waiting doggedly for the pain to recede to a tolerable level. By now, I knew it was never going to recede at all, even a little. Maybe there are no good deaths, I don't know. I knew Susan had one of the bad ones. I estimated I had at most another day or two in me. It would call for a bit of cunning. The only thing left I could possibly give my son Jesse that he would accept from me was my life insurance benefit, and there was an anti-suicide clause. So it would have to look like an accident. I was going over a short list of 3 finalist methods, weighing their respective pluses and minuses, when the knock on the door startled me so badly I backhanded a cup of coffee clear off the warming plate and onto the floor. An unexpected knock in the dead of night is alarming even if you have a clean conscience. Or so I imagine. I had my brain do a hasty search for things this could be that wouldn't be catastrophic. By the time it reported failure, a small pipe and a gray plastic film can had been rendered temporarily invisible, and I was up out of my chair, halfway to the office door, and my fist was unobtrusively wrapped around the trackball of my turbo mouse, a solid plastic sphere about the size and weight of a cue ball. I can only wonder what organ directed all these actions, since my brain was fully occupied in the fruitless search for harmless explanations. Spinal cord, maybe. Silly, isn't it? I was planning my suicide and ready to kill in self-defense. No wonder humans own the planet. The knock came again as I reached the door. It was depressingly loud and firm. I could think of perhaps a dozen acquaintances or neighbors who might conceivably bang on my door in the small hours, but any of them would have done so softly, apologetically. They are, after all Canadians. There was a short list of maybe 4 friends who might feel entitled to wang away that assertively at that hour, secure in the certainty that I would be both awake and willing to fuck off for a while. But for one reason and another, I was fairly certain none of them could be on island just now. That left only discouraging possibilities. A raid of some kind. Someone bringing the news that a loved one was dead or badly hurt. A neighbor who wanted to tell me my house was on fire. The first home invader in the history of Heron Island. But number four was a joke. We did have a full-time RCMP officer on the island, Corporal McKenzie, but he had never made an arrest. Numbers two or three would be bad news, but the kind I would want to open my door to. It was number one that had me hesitating at the threshold. I had little to fear from a legitimate police raid. Nothing, really, except annoyance and brief indignity. My house and office were always scrupulously free of any seditious, proscribed, or obscene materials. My hard drive never contained anything remotely questionable whose encryption I did not trust absolutely. And the contents of the little gray plastic film can, while outstanding in quality, were of a quantity nobody could reasonably call anything but personal use. By a cheapskate. If part of your job description is pissing off the powerful in the public prints, you're wise to keep a tight ship at all times. But one of the things this knock might be was a mistake. Heron Island is about half an hour from Vancouver. The drug squad there are a right bunch of cowboys, love to make surprise busts. The trouble was they were notorious fuck-ups. You probably read about the time they kicked in the wrong door, and the 20-year-old college student inside was unwise enough to be caught with a TV remote control in his hand that, in a certain light, looked not too much unlike some sort of Martian weapon. He had to be killed to ensure the safety of the officers, who then learned that the guy they actually wanted lived next door, or rather used to, he had moved 6 months earlier. If you missed that story, you must have heard about the squad that crashed their way into a house they had been surveilling continuously for days, were startled to find a child's birthday party in progress inside, and were forced to blow the family watchdog into hamburger in front of a room full of horrified kids and terrified parents for trying to protect them. There turned out to be no drugs or drug users present. In both cases, an internal inquiry totally exonerated the cops of any improper actions. If, thanks to some totally typical typo, it was those guys out there knocking on my door, I definitely did not want to open it with a weapon in my hand, even one as low-tech as a plastic trackball. But what if, as seemed more likely, it was some sort of nut bar out there? An insomniac Jehovah's Witness, say, or a tourist ripped on acid, or a belligerent drunk, or the new boyfriend of an old girlfriend in search of karmic balance? In that case, it might be better if I didn't, literally, drop the ball. I am skinny, frail, and no fighter. Any edge at all was welcome. Most likely of all, of course, was the secret nightmare of any opinion columnist bright enough to get published, the disgruntled reader who decides to make his rebuttal in person with a utensil. There is no opinion you could conceivably express, however innocuous, that won't piss off somebody, somewhere. It was comforting to be in Canada, where there are almost no handguns, despite everything the government can do to keep them out. But that didn't mean that the guy who was even now knocking on my door for the third time wasn't doing so with the butt of a shotgun, or the hilt of a butcher knife, the sweet spot of a Louisville slugger, the handle of an axe, or, for that matter, the tip of a chainsaw. Maybe, I thought, I should forget my silly trackball and start thinking in terms of turning my half-liter can of Zippo fluid into a squeeze-operated flamethrower, or some speaker wire into a noose, or, ow, whoever it was out there said, cut it out! The voice was muffled. I could hear it at all only because he was speaking loudly, and the words were baffling when I had thought myself as confused as possible already. Cut it out? I was standing still, frozen with indecision. What the hell was it I was supposed to stop doing?
Being so paranoid, he called.
I stood, if possible, stiller. A comedy voice, somewhere between Michael Jackson and a Mel Blanc cartoon character.
You didn't used to be so suspicious.
That voice tickled at the edges of memory. Deep memory. 20 years? No, it felt like more. 30, maybe. Which would make it... Oh, wow. The trackball fell forgotten from my hand to the carpet. I opened my mouth and hesitated, caught by a ridiculous dilemma. I thought I knew who he was now, and for the life of me I couldn't recall his real name, just what everybody used to call him, and I certainly wasn't about to use that. But screw names, how could it possibly be him out there? I wanted to fling open the door and couldn't bring myself to touch the knob.
It's me, all right, Slim.
I stepped back a pace. For the first time, I began to wonder whether I was having my own first encounter with a dead person, like Susan's visit from her father.
"You didn't used to be this superstitious either," he said.
My words sounded stupid to me even as they were leaving my mouth, but I couldn't seem to hold them back.
"How do I know that's you?"
Silence for 5 seconds. Then,
"You never did the bunny, but you would have."
I gasped and flipped on the outside light and flung open the door and gaped like the cartoon character he sounded like and still faintly resembled.
"Smelly," I cried. "Jesus Christ, you are alive!"
No question it was him. He looked much the same, only balder. But far more significant, he smelled just as unbelievably, unforgettably horrible as ever. My eyes began to water.
"I wish I could say the same for you," he said. "My God, you're at the end of your rope."
I felt I should be offended, but couldn't work up the energy.
"How the hell could you possibly know that?" I demanded. "You just fucking got here."
He frowned and shook his head.
"I'm going to have to fix you first, and there's no time. But you're no use to me like this."
"Why would I want to be of use to you? Do I owe you something I'm not remembering? Look," his name came back. "Look, Xandor, I ain't broken. And even if I was, I didn't ask to be fixed."
"I don't care. I need you to help me prevent the torture, rape, and butchery of an entire family," he said,
and stepped into my office.
Well, there's as good a place as any to stop for a little comic relief, and fortunately I've got some, thanks to Michael Monteleone, who is putting together a retrospective DVD and possibly some CDs of the late, great Lord Buckley. He knows that I'm a major Lord Buckley fan, and he sent me a bunch of beautiful stuff, including a disc of stuff he calls Footlocker Gems. He writes, "I tracked down Buckley's last aide-de-camp, Louis Foremaster, in a derelict house in the desert about 10 miles from the Las Vegas Strip. We talked for hours, and when I left, he opened a small, dirty yellow footlocker and pulled out a bunch of tapes and gave them to me. Here now is one of them. It happens this is Lord Buckley reading a poem by Joseph Newman, who is Paul Newman's uncle. It's a fairly famous poem that was written the year I was born, 1948, and I just love it. It's called Black Cross.
And a lot of people worried about religion, how to do it, how to be in there tight, how to be on the beat, how to be in there, how to give from the melon of life, how to swing, how to come on like a wild mother peacock. It's very simple. That old Hezekiah Jones of Hogback County, he lived on a hill in the weather-beaten hovel, and all the cat owns a twig, a plot, and a bed, and some books, and a hoe, and a shovel. Old Hezekiah, man, he was black as the soil he was hoeing. Worked pretty hard to make both ends meet. He raised what he ate, a few cents over he bought corn liquor that he'd knocked down and eaten, a few cents more that he'd put in the cupboard against what he called the rainy season. But he never got to stash more than $2 or $3. He blew it. For this or that reason, but the white folks wrong. They knew old Hezekiah said he's harmless enough, but the way that I figure, you better put on them goddamn boots. Reading ain't no good for an ignorant Negro. Reverend Green of the White Man's Church finally got to coming over to ask you all about the pearly kingdom and to save your soul for the Lord Jehovah. Do you believe in the Lord? Said the white man's preacher. Old Hezekiah pocketed his frosty belt. So I can't say yes, so I ain't gonna say it, because I've never seen the Lord nowhere, no how. Did you believe in the church? Said the white man's preacher. Old Hezekiah said, church is divided. See, they can't make up their mind. I can't either, see. Man, I'm just like them, see. I ain't decided. You believe in heaven? Said the white man's preacher. Where you go, if you're good, if you last me what? I'm good, said Hezekiah. They're as good as I'm able, but see, I don't expect nothing from heaven. Oh, the Lord. You don't believe in nothing, said the white man's preacher. Yes, I do, said Hezekiah. Tell you, I believe that a man should be beholden to his neighbor, without the rewards of heaven, or the fear of hell's fire. Well, there's a lot of good ways for a man to be wicked. And they hung Hezekiah as high as a pigeon. And the nice folks round said, well, he had it coming. Because the son of a bitch didn't have no religion.
And here's one more very short Lord Buckley bit, this one excerpted from the album His Royal Hypnus, which you can score at Amazon.com. This is from a longer rap about Cabenza the Gascar, the Gasser. He was a conquistador cat who spent quite a bit of time stomping around North America having no fun at all, and this little 30-second excerpt is him writing back home to King Ferdinand of Spain, telling him how things have been going in the New World. I call the excerpt The Tilted Picnic.
He said, your most royal swinging majesty, I've been on a lot of sad tours. I've been on a lot of mad beat, bent up, down, grading excursions. I've been on a lot of tilted picnics and a lot of double unhung parties. He said, I suffered from pavement rash. I've been bent, twisted, spent, de-gigged, flipped, trapped, and babapped. But he said, I never was so drunk in my whole life like I was with this here last gig you put me on. He said, it was rough. It was dull rough.
I've had days like that. I love that guy. Michael Monteleone is putting together, as I said, a DVD documentary about Lord Buckley. The bits he sent me are just incredible. Include interviews with Robin Williams, Jonathan Winters, people like that. I mean, if you don't know his lordship, Michael Monteleone would like to hip you. And unfortunately, I've managed to lose his email address, so I am unable to tell you exactly what the holdup is on this documentary, which has been in the works for quite a while. If you're as curious as I am, you can express your interest and seek further information by writing to Michael Monteleone at Post Office Box 222, Vashon, Washington, 98070. That's Vashon, Washington State. Ask him to drop me an email at spiderweb@shaw.ca so I can reconnect myself. And now back to the novel Very Bad Deaths by Spider Robinson, which is already in progress.
Flashback, 1967. St. William Joseph College, Olympia, New York, USA. Chapter 1. I felt like the wandering Catholic. Wandering apostate, anyway. Wandering around the campus on the first Sunday of September 1967 and of my sophomore year, looking for my room. It wasn't where it was supposed to be. Or rather, it was where it was supposed to be, Dabland Hall, room 220, but there were two other guys' names on its door. And two guys with those names inside, already unpacked, totally uninterested in my dilemma. As I said, it was Sunday. There was no one anywhere on campus to consult. And nothing for it but to wander the whole dorm, squinting at the 3x5 index card on every single damn door, looking for one that read, Russell Walker / Sean McSorley. The only consolation was looking forward to seeing Sean, knowing what a meal he would make of this screw-up. His sense of humor was almost Krasnerian. I knew he would have me laughing. My faith wavered when I finished the whole dorm without finding either of our names. Could I have missed a card? Certainly. Did I want to re-canvass the building for it? Not a whole lot. Sighing deeply, I checked on my VW. Still not broken into, still packed to the consistency of a rubber brick with my stuff, and trudged uphill to the other men's dorm, Nalligan Hall. I never did find a card with my name or Sean's, but on the third floor near the front I found a door with no card. Instead, there was an envelope affixed to it with scotch tape, and my name, only, was written in ink on the envelope. I pulled the envelope off the door, leaving a scotch tape tail, and tried the knob. Locked. The envelope contained no keys, just a brief note.
Dear Russell, please report to me before checking into your room. Your situation has changed. Cordially yours, Ivan LaForce, Resident Advisor, Room 345.
What the hell did that mean? Nothing pleasant, I suspected. My instincts have always been good.
Sean's been drafted, LaForce told me.
Oh, shit! He nodded.
That's exactly right.
He was way too old to be in college. His bearing, his haircut, his dress, his room, everything screamed that he had in the immediate past been in one of the armed forces. I correctly assumed Vietnam.
He failed one too many courses last year, and last week the draft board pulled his deferment.
Oh, the poor bastard. He nodded again. No, you don't understand, I said. I hate to see anybody get shot at, but this is like they drafted Oscar Levant. He looked pained, but said nothing. Does it seem strange to you that I heard the news that way, that Sean didn't phone me? This was a long time ago. You wouldn't believe what long distance cost back then. Sean had doubtless written me the news. For all I knew, the letter was even now being delivered to my parents' house back in New Jersey. I wanted to cry. Sean in the jungle was as unimaginable as Mr. Rogers buying smack. After a while, I said, "So what happens now? Is there like a list of guys in the same boat that I get to select a new roommate from?" Now he looked constipated.
"Actually," he said reluctantly, "he's already been selected."
"The hell he has!" This time he looked nauseous.
"Look, Russ, I'm going to ask you to help me out here."
Now I started feeling nauseous. Anytime the administration asks your help, it's time to change your name and move to someplace with no extradition.
"Yeah? How?" "I've looked over your record.
You're an unusually tolerant man. Do you know that?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, I do. Right now I'm tolerating being dicked around when I should be unpacking in my new room somewhere." "The school needs an unusually tolerant man just now," he said, ignoring my sarcasm. "I'm hoping you're that man."
I thought I saw a light in the undergrowth. Oh, my God, they actually admitted a sixth Negro? He paled.
No.
I snorted. Sorry, I got carried away there for a minute. Out of a student population approaching 1,000, exactly 5 students were black. All male. That's another clue how long ago this was.
"No, this is in regard to a student who's already enrolled here."
"Then what's this about?" I broke off, blinded. The undergrowth had suddenly burst into flame. "Jesus Christ, you want me to room with that crazy Serbo-Croatian? With Smelly? That's it, isn't it?" He had gone from pale to brick red.
"With Zandor Zudanigo, yes."
"Son of a bitch," I said. I couldn't even ask why me. He had already told me. Zandor Zudanigo was a campus legend and deserved to be. Not for his mathematical talent, which was rumored to be better than first rate, nor for his striking ugliness, which was of clock-stopping magnitude, nor even for his habit of wandering around the campus in pajamas, mumbling to himself and writing on an invisible blackboard. These things by themselves would have made him a colorful campus character, a figure of fun, a kind of mascot. But what promoted him from risible eccentric to world-class wackadoo and hopeless outcast was his smell. No, smell doesn't begin to touch it. Even stench is inadequate. Another word is needed. Perhaps reek or miasma or possibly fetor. You could have planted beans in his body odor. Some said it would show up on radar. Paint discolored as he walked past. Flies dropped from the sky behind him. This elicited plenty of reaction, of course, but Smelly did not seem to realize it. If someone asked him why he didn't bathe, he simply stared, blank-faced, waiting for them to say something. If someone became offended enough to scream at him, he literally failed to notice, didn't even flinch. If someone got mad and punched him, he didn't seem to notice that either, simply waited for the blows to stop, and then walked away as if nothing had happened, or if necessary, crawled. Hell, in his way, the guy was as weird as I was.
"Okay," I said, "what's our goddamn room number?"
It was a pleasure watching LaFour's jaw drop. How can I begin to convey to you just how long ago all this was? The Beatles were still together. They would always be together. They'd just performed All You Need Is Love and Hey Jude live for the whole world that July. Forget Altamont, Woodstock hadn't happened yet. Brian Epstein was dead, but Brian Jones was still alive. So was Che Guevara. There was not a single footprint on the moon, and most adults believed there never would be. All educated people knew that the Cold War would, in our lifetimes, culminate in an apocalyptic nuclear exchange that would sterilize the planet. Some of us railed against it, some fought to prevent it, some accepted it, but none of us doubted it. Nobody, I mean nobody anywhere, would have thought it conceivable that the Soviet Union might ever simply stop. It wasn't possible enough to be the premise of a science fiction story. Bobby and Reverend Dr. King were both still alive. Charlie Company had not yet saved My Lai. LBJ was president, and it was unimaginable that he would not run again. Nobody knew that Chicago cops were vicious thugs and Mayor Daley was a monster, except black people who lived in Chicago. Paul Krassner had not yet coined the term yippies for the people who would go there to protest the war. You could smoke a cigarette just about anywhere except church or schoolroom. Nobody realized they minded it yet, and the dread dangers of sidestream smoke had not yet been faked. You could smoke on an airplane. No, here's how long ago it was. You could buy a plane ticket under any name you liked, with cash, and board without showing ID or passing a metal detector. The term terrorist was not yet commonly heard outside Israel. That's how long ago it was for the world. Here's how long ago it was for me. I was entering my sophomore year at St. William Joseph, a Catholic college run by the Maronite Order in Olympia, a medium-sized town in northern New York State. Only my third year as a free human being. My parents still believed I was a Catholic. And a virgin. I could still count my lovers on the fingers of one hand and give the peace sign at the same time. I had been drinking alcohol for a little less than a year, smoking pot for 6 months. I had never taken any other drug and didn't ever expect to. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a lawyer, an English teacher, or an anarchist. One of those. Long time ago. Maybe this will convey something. I basically had only two heroes at that time, Ed Sedakis and Paul Krassner. You've probably heard of Krassner, youngest violinist ever to play Carnegie Hall at age 6, Lenny Bruce's roommate, uncredited editor of his autobiography, once took acid with Groucho Marx. Publisher since 1958 of The Realist, an underground satirical journal dedicated to outraging as many people as possible, ideally to apoplexy. He had, in fact, just that summer pulled off what was probably his greatest prank. A writer named Manchester had written a controversial book about the Kennedy clan, and their lawyers had managed to force the deletion of a few chapters before publication. The Realist ran a piece purporting to be some of the suppressed material. A dazed Jackie Kennedy is wandering around the plane in search of a bathroom where she can wipe her husband's blood from her when she opens the wrong door and finds LBJ having carnal knowledge of the corpse in an apparent attempt to make an entry wound look like an exit wound. Well, it's probably hard to imagine now, but back then, if you merely said in print that the President of the United States had sex with the corpses of his enemies, some people got all upset. A shitstorm of rage descended on Krassner. There was some talk of having him nuked. He spent the next year on the lecture circuit, unapologetically reminding audience after outraged audience, "Who are we to judge? It may have been an act of love." Anyway, that was one of my heroes. The other was Ed Sedakis. Him, I don't think you know. In the Catholic all-boys high school Ed and I had attended, you were required to receive Holy Communion with the rest of your homeroom at Friday afternoon Mass. That meant that most of us spent Friday morning lined up for confession. Terminal boredom with the prospect of humiliation at the end of it, the only consolation being that the humiliation would be about as private as possible. One particular Friday, the apprehension level spiked. A new priest, Father Anderson, had recently rejoined the faculty after several years as a missionary in Kaohsiung, Taiwan. Rumor made the place sound worse than the walled city of Hong Kong. Father Anderson himself looked just terrifying, bald and hatchet-faced, never smiling, with thunderclap eyebrows. Nobody wanted to get on his line for confession that morning. A brother had to assign guys to it. Ed Sedakis was one of them. Until that day, he had been, in the judgment of one and all, student and teacher alike, just another asshole. He had no particular rep, one way or another. Then he stepped into Father Anderson's confessional and became immortal. Outside, all went on as before. That is, nothing whatsoever went on. Pin drop silence. Totally bored adolescent males fiddled with their neckties and silently struggled to think of anything interesting besides sexual fantasies, and of course there was nothing. Sound of grate sliding shut. The light above the left-hand side of the confessional went out. A student pushed aside the heavy curtain and exited, trying not to look relieved and failing. Sound of a noisier grate sliding open on the right side. Silence resumed for 30 eternal seconds, then was shattered by the voice of Father Anderson. He screamed so loud he required a full chest of air for each word.
You did what?
The last word seemed to blow Ed from the confessional like a cannonball. The curtain couldn't get out of his way fast enough, so he took it with him the first few steps and then tossed it aside. His face was absolutely expressionless, but the color of a ripe plum. In seconds, he had left the chapel. The kid waiting his turn on the other side of Father Anderson's closet emerged only seconds later, looked around at us, and got in another line. We looked round at each other in slow motion. Then a beehive buzz sprang up, which the brothers allowed to go on a little longer than usual. Then everything returned to normal, except that nobody went into Father Anderson's confessional on either side. No brother made anyone do so. A few minutes later, he emerged, poker-faced, white as a sheet, and left without even glancing at any of us. 5 months later, he was killed in a car crash. Ed, sensibly, never told anyone what it was he'd done. Bribes, threats, and appeals to his compassion all failed. I never saw him again after graduation. Doubt I ever will. But to this day, I wonder what he confessed that morning. And so, I imagine, does everybody else. Anyway, that should give you a rough idea of just how young I was that first day of sophomore year. My two heroes were Paul Krasner and Ed Sedakis. I was as ready as anyone alive to meet and move in with Xandor Zudenigo.
Sad to say, Paul Krasner folded the realist several years back, but he's still outraging people. If you go to his website, www.paulkrasner.com, for instance, you'll be offered an opportunity to purchase a suitable-for-framing print of his famous Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster, which was created by Mad Magazine artist Wally Wood, sort of as a center-spread parody. It featured basically all the Disney characters in the world either having sex with one another or urinating or defecating upon one another. It's totally outrageous. One of my favorite pictures of all time. And you can pick up a copy for only $35 at Krasner's website. You can also find copies of his most recent books, such as Woody Allen Meets Tung Fu, Pot Stories for the Soul, his latest book, One Hand Jerking, Reports from an Investigative Satirist, with a foreword by Harry Shearer. And, of course, there's the classic Sex, Drugs, and the Twinkie Murders. Also, if you go to that website, you can hear Paul introduced by Homer Simpson himself. As for Ed Sedakis, that wasn't his real name, and I haven't heard from him in decades, and I never did find out what the hell it was he did. Now here's a really obscure track from Louis Foremaster's Footlocker Gems. This is a recording of somebody else cracking up his lordship, apparently at a party. I'm not sure who this cat is. I think I can hear his lordship referring to him as Trent Franks, but the only Google reference I can find for that name is a Congress critter from Arizona, 10 years younger than me, and this dude ain't him. Anyway, here's somebody cracking up the great Richard Lord Buckley with The Pussycat Story.
Well, it was, isn't it? Oh, it wasn't an anecdote, Richard. Not a story, but it was about a ship's cat, you know. Got a ship during the war. and we had a cat. And they're a separate breed. They're gone now, but they were seeming in their own way. And this was a big black one. Very pretty and muscular like a bulldog. And just about grown. And he's green eyes. And he stalked around that ship. He was reasonably sure that he was a captain. Since everyone else seemed to be an inferior breed. He knew he was prettier than any of us and quite a bit blacker. Quite a bit blacker than the blackest one we had. So he assumed he was a captain. And he was navigating the ship over to North Ireland. And he rode with us to Belfast.
He rode from North Ireland to Belfast?
No, no. North Ireland contains Belfast. He rode from New York.
Oh, I see.
To Belfast. And we're in Belfast. He went ashore, but he didn't find the pickings as good as he did in the United States. In fact, he came back to get something to eat. You know, England was... That's England, North Ireland. It was very hungry during the war. And it was being well-bombed, and there was a curfew. And he didn't dig it so much, so he only went ashore for short periods of time. And one day, we're at the dock there. And a cold wind was blowing, and it was about 35 degrees. Once in a while, a wisp of snow. And the stern of the ship was pointing out to sea. And we had a solid rail on that ship about waist high with about a 6-inch flat platform all around it. Covered the whole ship. Solid steel rail. And we were on the stern with the wind blowing aft. We were breaking up pieces of bread. The seagulls in the British Isles were hungry during the war, and we had at least 200 of them. They were putting on quite an aerial display. We'd break up these pieces of bread and toss them up into the stiff breeze. And the seagulls would come in from left field like DiMaggio after a fly ball, you know. Yeah. Big glissando and turn over on the side and nail it just before it hit the water. And it was fascinating. We all had bread and we were doing all this. One big seagull came drifting down, flapping his wings and putting on the brakes, and settled on the exact stern of that ship on the rail with his hind end toward us, looking out to sea. And I was watching him. He was within 10 feet of me. And I suddenly happened to glance forward on the starboard side, and here came the cat. And he was way down low and rotating his hind end and looking into his green eyes. You could look right down in and see the devil sitting down to dinner in hell, you know, the fiend incarnate, the murderer. And he was making little Walt Disney type zigzag runs from a pile of line to a bollard and everything to stay camouflaged as well as he could, but get closer to the seagull. When finally he's got no more cover, he goes into the deadly tigerish charge and sails up in the air to land on the seagull's back. Well, I would have liked to have seen him and the seagull fight because they're about the same size. But the seagull never, to this day, knows that cat was there. Just as the cat was within a foot of landing square in his back with his claws in his neck, the seagull flew straight out to sea, 10 or 12 feet, and then banked up and sharply to the right. And the cat flew straight out to sea after him, and not over 6 inches from contact, and he banked sharply up to the right, too. And the seagull continued to climb, and the cat hung there in a beautiful sort of a ballet gesture. But he watches the seagull's caboose getting smaller and smaller, and he realizes that he can't climb with this bird. And it looks quite wistful, is reaching real longingly with his front claws and staring at the seagull and saying, "Hell, I missed it." And after a little while, it occurs to him that he hasn't hit the deck yet. But he's a cat and always lands on his feet, so he's not worried. And after he's dropped quite a while in his statuesque pose, he looks down at the deck and sees the cold green North Atlantic. And he says, "Ah!" And he's not going.
And he's what?
He's not going to the water.
No.
He turns around in the air, and he starts to swim through the air back to the ship. He's never flown before. And he's got about 15... You want to tell the story? He's got about 15 feet to go back to the ship and maybe 15 up. And he begins to rotate all four claws, which are spread very wide. And he's getting so many RPM on each claw. And the tail, which has grown double in size, is flapping, you know, to steer him. And the mouth is uttering obscenities. And the eyes are popping. And the hair is up so far. And he's undulating the torso to assist the flying. And the efforts are so frantic that if his claws had been an eighth of an inch bigger, I think he'd have made it, you know. But on such short notice, he couldn't learn to fly. So gravity inexorably took him down to the water. When he saw that all hope air type, he switched over from air type swimming to water type swimming and hit the water and shot like a torpedo under the surface a few feet and swam over to a piling and grabbed it and went swarming up the piling. And every place his claws hit after he left, smoke came out of the hose. And he sailed along the dock like a charging lion and bounced once in the gangway, went into the fiddly, which is a big dark room of iron grills at the top of the engine room where great heat comes up. And he ran out behind a ventilator. We were laughing so hard that we went around in there to see if he was all right. Anybody that reached to pet him got a bloody stump, you know. Well, he was too smart to get off in the United Kingdom. He was so hungry, he would probably end up on the menu over there. But he stayed out of sight all day and came out to eat at night and fraternized with no one during the trip home. And he had his bags packed, and he was the first one ashore. He changed ships because he knew he made such an ass out of himself, which cats never do, you know. Jumped in the water over a piece of tail, you know, which you're not supposed to.
That is absolutely the most beautiful, recent, solid contemporary, delightfully woven, exquisite mosaic and beautiful sound that I've heard these many years.
Proletarian, yeah.
All right, it's time to play you out with some music, and I've decided it's finally time to play you some filk music. If you need to be told what filk music is, a one-hour podcast isn't near long enough. About the only way you can thumbnail it is to say it's music you might hear at a science fiction convention. If you go to cdbaby.com and search for Dodeca Records, that's D-O-D-E-K-A, you can hear representative samples of some of the better folk singers, such as Steve McDonald, Bill Roper, Erica Neely, Bill Sutton, and particularly the fellow I'm going to play us out with, the filkish legend Nate Buckland of Minneapolis, who has been a friend of mine for going on 30 years now, and is one of the very few human beings ever to appear as a character in one of my books. I generally don't believe in putting real people in my books because it's not fair, they got no way to shoot back, but I made an exception in Nate's case. He'll take us home with the final track of his 2001 CD, Rainbow's Edge, a track called When I Stop Reading SF.
I'm singing to let all my friends know of a change coming in my life. No, I'm not about to join the army, and I'm not gonna take a new wife. Though in some ways it's kinda tempting, I won't take a night school class. But I'm making a big decision, and I can't just let it pass. If I'd been through a terrible breakup, and you felt that I'd been unfair, you'd take me aside and you'd chide me, but I know that you'd still care. You'd love me if I needed a wheelchair, you'd love me if I went deaf, but will you still love me when I stop reading SF? I won't see the year 3000, I'll never set foot on Mars. I'm developing serious doubts about if we're ever gonna reach the stars. We won't get invented by aliens for reasons that are much the same. Serious future fiction may have its merits, but I don't want to play that game. If I'd been through a terrible breakup and you felt that I'd been unfair, you'd take me aside and you'd chide me, but I know that you'd still care. You'd love me if I needed a wheelchair, you'd love me if I went deaf, but will you still love me when I stop reading SF? As a kid I loved science fiction, but now I hope I'm a man. I've had it with being a writer, and I'm burned out on being a fan. The future still concerns me, as I hope it matters to you. But all fiction is lies, is hard on my eyes, and I want to read something that's true. If I'd been through a terrible breakup, and you felt that I'd been unfair, you'd take me aside and you'd chide me, but I know that you'd still care. You'd love me if I needed a wheelchair, you'd love me if I went deaf, But will you still love me when I stop reading SF? But will you still love me when I stop reading SF? But will you still love me when I stop reading SF?
That's Nate Bucklin, B-U-C-K-L-I-N. Find him by searching under Dodeca Records at cdbaby.com. Well, that's Spider on the Web number 31. Once again, I thank you for your insanely generous donations. Thanks to you, I hope to keep coming back every week with science fiction, song, and general shenanigans. Now let's both go see if we can't make somebody else smile.